Anybody have any practice-related questions that they would like to ask? Yes?
I'm curious what the advantages of... Or I can wait until the microphone comes. What the advantages of using the feet for walking meditation rather than the breath are. I noticed that I could use either. I can think of some possible benefits, but I'm curious.
You know, I'm not sure I've ever thought about that before. but I suppose one advantage is it makes walking into more of a different practice. I mean, because you're moving and you've got your eyes open and everything, it is different anyway. It's different in terms that maintaining awareness is much easier, and you don't have dullness, but sustaining attention is more difficult. And I know that some people that teach that walking meditation where you observe the breath and walking at the same time, and you actually make your breath coincide with your steps, which I don't like that because it involves way too much doing, you know. With the walking, if you look at the way that that I recommended using walking, you take advantage of the fact that you can walk in different paces. You can stop, you can exercise different sense faculties. There's a whole lot of things that you can do as a part of that practice. And you wouldn't be able to do those same things in quite the same way using the breath. On the other hand, you could follow your breath while you're walking. You could. I mean, there's nothing inherently wrong with that.
I was thinking that I'm already sort of used to paying attention to my breath, but on the other hand, that might be another advantage of paying attention to the feet, is
something
special about the breath, and yeah, maybe a chance to recognize patterns across domains.
Yes. That's right.
So another answer you once gave to this was that when you're walking, the sensations of your feet are the most noticeable and strongest sensation. And so,
yes,
as a rule of kind of using the strongest sensation wherever you are as your anchor, that was another reason for it.
Right. Did I say that once before?
Yeah.
Oh, good for me.
That's a good one.
Yeah, because that's, I agree with me totally. Yeah. That's really quite right.
So I have a different practice question, which is, there's a note in, you know, stage five, that the importance of stage five is you really, if you don't overcome dullness, subtle dullness, then you can kind of get in a trap where you get things that look like higher meditation states, but they're not, and you could continue practicing and get in the wrong place. But on the other hand, this sort of, you want to be able to experiment with different practices and avoid these kinds of pitfalls. So there's one sense which you could try and rigidly follow exactly the things in the book, or you could try and have some more freedom and experiment. How do you kind of experiment without being too rigid and yet don't fall in whichever of the traps there are that you could fall into?
Well, to experiment is very important. And especially by the time you get to stage five, you should be trying different things, absolutely. Just knowing what the possible problems are should be enough. Of course, you know, it goes the other way too. That's the thing with how do you communicate something like this. Because I make that statement, and somebody may just get overly worried about, oh no,
I've got to make sure there's not the slightest bit of subtle dullness, you know. And whenever you pass stage five, you know, or they just spend a whole lot of time, you know, worrying about it, questioning, doubting, you know. I don't think I have dullness, but maybe I do. So, you know, the best way is to be able to check with somebody else, to be able to check with the teacher, to be able to check with someone else, you know, who's been through stage five, or has been trained, so that, you know, they can assure you that, in fact, you're not going to completely overcome subtle dullness in stage five. You're going to get to the point where, as a result of sitting, you are less dull by the time the bell rings than you were when you sat down. But the state of alertness and conscious power that you have is going to continue to increase for a long time to come. And so probably the best way for somebody to understand that and put it together with a warning, you know, not to skip this stage, which is, yeah, you don't want to skip this stage entirely, but you don't want to get overly worried about it, is to remember when what I give as examples of being when you're just totally conscious, no dullness at all, like in a life-threatening situation. Now, you're not going to, you know that's what the potential is, but you can't realistically expect to spend 45 minutes or an hour in that state of alertness on a regular basis. It's not going to happen. So maybe putting those two in juxtaposition with each other will help you realize that, okay, you know, this is about not dwelling in a state of sustained subtle dullness and believing it's something that it's not. But it's not about being as totally alert as is humanly possible.
So. It sounds like part of the problem there is just not even realizing, and you can be dull and not even, you know, stably dull, and then not even perceiving dullness.
And that's the thing. If you realize that you're always in some degree of dullness, you know, when you're out in the world and doing things and having a good time and feel wide awake, you're still in a state of dullness. So that's what you have to realize is that subtle states of dullness, they really are subtle. And they're so subtle that at first, and when you first hear about this in stage four and stage five, you hear about subtle dullness. And the first thing you discover is that it's so subtle that you have to learn to recognize it. Because otherwise you don't know that it's there. And then, oh yeah, and you recognize, oh, that's been there all along. That's it's been there a lot. So. The reason that that's so important, though, and the reason I put that warning in there, is because way, way too often that has happened, that people meditate in a state of sustained subtle dullness, and they think they're having a profound meditation experience. But no amount of sitting in that state is going to generate any kind of insight or awakening. And that seems to have been what happened Samatha meditation got a bad reputation because so many people were sitting in dullness.
That's where the dry vipassana, when that practice was introduced, it's why it took off and became so popular, because you'd have generation after generation of monks sitting around in subtle dullness and not getting anywhere. And so the dry insight movement kind of went too far the other way, you know, throughout concentration, throughout samatha and samadhi, and said, that's all it's about is mindfulness. Just be mindful, mindful, mindful. And that was a reaction to a very real problem, that problem of sitting in subtle dhamma. That became very widespread throughout a major part of Buddhist culture, of people sitting in subtle dullness and thinking they were having profound, powerful meditations. And of course not becoming awakened as a result of it. And so it began to be the belief that, well, you know, the world's fallen into such a state now that, you know, only very rare individuals can achieve awakening. Well, if you're doing the wrong thing, that's really true. So that's why that warning is in there, and that's why, you know, I think in the time of the Sangha, it wouldn't have been the reason to stress so strongly how important it is. I think at the time of the Sangha, they might not have even realized how easy it was to skip it. I think people may have discovered that later on and got into a habit because it hadn't been specifically identified as a potential problem. Pass back to Andrea and then John.
I guess so, more on subtle dullness in stage 5, just to make sure I understood what you were saying before. So, I've certainly experienced the subtle dullness, which we all have every minute of our life,
yeah.
But I haven't had that sort of like sort of blissed out, like, oh, that was such a great meditation,
yeah,
kind of subtle dullness. And were you guys saying that you should experience it during stage 5 to keep from sort of dancing around stage 5 and, or, I'm not sure.
Okay, you ready?
I guess so.
You might not have that state of sustained subtle dullness that feels really pleasant, and when you describe it to yourself, it sounds like a description of an advanced meditative state. You might not have that, okay? But if you don't know that it's a potential problem, you most likely will end up discovering that. You'll have trained yourself very well to recognize gross dullness or strong dullness and progressive subtle dullness, and you keep those from happening, and you're very good at that. But not realizing that there is a sustained subtle dullness, that will develop and that will deepen, and you will have this feeling like, oh, I've got really single pointed concentration, and boy, I feel so good, feel so nice. Bell ring, oh, I don't really want to move, this is just so nice, I'm going to stay here. You don't realize you're in a state of dullness. But that doesn't need to ever happen to you. If you overcome strong dullness and you know that there is such a thing as subtle dullness still to be overcome, you begin working on that, you may very well never, or you may only occasionally find yourself slipping into that.
Just keeping the stage 5 party rolling.
Yeah.
I guess this is sort of stage 5 plus. There's a thing that comes up in stage 5 and after, where there's a goal, maybe multiple goals, that is the goal or are the goals of the stage. But then there are expedient means that you provide to achieve those goals, which sort of become goals in and of themselves, even though they're not essential to the state. So to stop being so vague, like in stage five, you are doing the body scan, right? And a goal is to discover the sort of prana flows, and that's really an expedient means for sharpening up your perception, increasing your mindfulness, and getting through stage five. It's not really a goal in and of itself, but there's an interesting thing where to do the practice at stage six, to do experiencing the whole body with the breath as it's given in the instructions, you need access to that perception of prana. So if you, and similarly, I guess this is less extreme, not extreme, but this is, it's a little more tenuous, but for instance, there's a jhana given at stage six. You don't have to achieve the jhana at all, much less master it, to get through stage six, theoretically, but I imagine it would be a huge boon in doing the jhanas of the later stages that you give. But you could move on without it. So my question is, what should you do if you achieve the primary goal without achieving the expedient means? So if your perception of prana is limited or not there, but your mindfulness is quite sharp and you haven't overcome subtle dullness, do you hang out and sort of finish the job prana-wise, or do you move on? And if you move on, how then do you do the subsequent practice that relies on that?
Okay, good question. So if you understand that the point of looking for breath-related sensations in stage five is to sharpen up your perception, you know, less dullness, more mindfulness, and the most important thing is looking for them, then it'll do its job and you'll get to stage six. Okay. Even if you never found them.
Yes.
So that's not a problem. But then you come to the description of experiencing the whole body with the breath and using that as jhana. And if you haven't found those breath related sensations, then you can't do the practice as described. But you can still do the practice. You can still do whole body meditation, and you can still gain the same benefits from it. You can even enter jhana using, you can still do a whole body jhana, even if you're not using the breath sensations. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't keep you from that. The reason that, really, sooner or later, you're going to feel those pranic sensations. At least in my experience, I've never known anybody that hasn't, right? So, because that's something that, you know, if it hasn't started by stage seven, it does by stage eight, and it becomes very strong. So it's going to happen eventually. The reason for encouraging people to practice in such a way that they experience those sensations earlier and work with them in a milder form is so that when they do come up, they're not so disruptive, not so painful, easier to manage. Have you ever heard about Kundalini rising and descriptions of Kundalini rising as being this horrible thing that, you know, violent, painful, disturbing, can't sleep for weeks, can't focus enough to work, you know, the Kundalini rising. That, by getting acquainted with these sensations much earlier and working with them much earlier, it's going to spare you that possibility. Not that if you don't, that means that that's going to happen. It doesn't mean that either. But it means it's a whole lot less likely to happen. And it does happen. It does happen to some people. And so anything that you can do to keep that from happening, but you don't have to actually. There's no reason why you actually have. And that's really an innovation of my teaching, is to have you start looking for those sensations at stage five, because I find that most people. I think of the one exception now, I have to say, maybe all people are able to find them eventually. And it doesn't really, even if they didn't, it wouldn't really make a lot of difference. But it seems that most, if not everyone, can. And by becoming aware of those sensations earlier, it's just better off later on. The other thing, too, is that everybody experiences, no, not everybody. Once again, I've got to watch these terms, you know. A lot of people, some people don't experience this at all, but a lot of people, when they first detect some breath-related sensation, they start to ask themselves, well, is that real or am I imagining it? And there's a great insight that comes from wrestling with that, which is at some point you realize, hey, that's what I'm experiencing. It doesn't matter where it's coming from. It doesn't matter whether it's coming from some mysterious energy that's moving in my arm or my leg, or whether it's coming from some kind of brain activity, or whether it's coming from some part of my mind that I call my imagination. I'm experiencing it. It doesn't really matter. So that's another advantage of it, is just that if your first experience of energy currents is feeling like there's a bolt of electricity going through you, like you just touched a light socket or something, you know, you don't get to experience that doubt, and you don't get to experience that wonder, and it doesn't give you the opportunity to develop that insight that, you know, if it's there, I'm experiencing it. So there is a sense in which it's real, regardless of what its origins are.
Thank you. And if I could just ask one very quick follow-up to that. So this is, I guess, specifically my situation, but if it's... So it's not that I don't feel any breath-related sensations, mm-hmm. but it's partial. So I feel gross breath-related sensations in my torso, the type that any uninstructed worldling would feel. And then there's some subtle breath-related sensations in my extremities, but there's a lot of blank spots mm-hmm. where there are sensations of various kinds, but not that pranic thing.
Right.
So how would one practice the whole body? So if I had none, it would be obvious I just use any old body sensations for the whole body breathing. Right. If I had it entirely, I would use that. Since I'm sort of in between, how would you recommend practicing at stage six?
I would recommend making sure that any breath-related sensations that you have been able to detect are part of what you make the focus of your attention, but that you fill in the gaps with other sensations that are there. And I think specifically, if you want to narrow it down, is that even if they're not changing with the breath, changing sensation, okay? Because that's going to give your mind exactly the kind of challenge you want. It's so much of your attentional power is going to have to go into holding all those changing sensations at once. It's not going to leave much room for thoughts and mental objects to catch a bit of attention here and there.
It's extremely helpful, thank you.
What's that?
That's extremely helpful, thank you.
You're welcome. I think Grace wanted to say something.
Yeah, just quickly, I was going to ask, would there ever be any reason to not explore pranic sensations? Like, what would those contests be? And, you know, if you had a choice, would there ever be a situation where it would be recommended that you don't?
Well, let me think about that. The thing is that when pranic sensations become disturbing, you pretty much can't choose to ignore them. They're going to be there. And like I say, looking for them, what I would say is looking for them for their own sake, just because you think it would be really cool, is probably the least valuable. It's going to make you most vulnerable to projecting imaginary sensations. That's kind of the rub that I have with the people that teach imagine feeling these currents. Okay? Because I think it makes it more difficult to become aware of the phenomenon that occurs spontaneously. So I think it's best to always be looking for them with a specific purpose in mind. Like, I'm doing this to brighten up, sharpen up my awareness, convert non-perceiving mind moments to perceiving mind moments. I'm doing this to occupy my conscious power so fully that there's no opportunity for various kinds of distractions to grab part of my attention. So if you always have some primary attention, which or intention, you have some primary purpose in mind for which the perception of the pranic sensations is secondary, then that will keep you from getting too wrapped up in the sensations for their own sake. But I can't really think of any reason for not observing them.
What if something shows up that is disturbing and you find that you can balance it? You can balance it intentionally? Is that okay? Or is it...
Can you give me more of a description? You say balancing, and that's the word that I'm reacting to.
Okay, so if there's a strong sensation on one side of the body and it's really pulling, feel that you can intentionally come to the other side of the body and explore the sensations there and then gradually balance out.
Absolutely. Yes, balance it. If you notice an imbalance, then you can balance it. One of the things that makes these sensations disturbing when they become strong spontaneously is that they'll hit blockages, and you'll have to intentionally work with them to move them past those blocks. But I discovered something on a very long plane trip once. Sitting in the seat of the plane, and there's nothing much else to do but meditate. And I was noticing that these pranic sensations were really out of balance. And so I just worked on rebalancing them every time I noticed, I'd bring them in. And what I discovered, I don't remember how long I was on the plane, but it was like 14, 16 hours or something like that. Maybe my mind's exaggerating. It was a heck of a long time. I'm not sure how long a plane can fly without refueling. I was going through all these different time zones because it was basically a east to west flight, and I didn't really have any jet lag afterwards. That was amazing. And so I tried that again. I was feeling sick. I had the flu or cold or something like that. Sort of laying there, okay, might as well meditate. The same thing, I noticed these imbalances, and I found that by rebalancing that pranic energy, I felt so much better. It's like, it relieved a lot of the symptoms. So ever since then, I'd say, yeah, go for it. If you're aware of that energy and you notice it's out of balance, work with it. Because in my experience, it only helps. It can be useful.
But aren't there other theories whereby illness is caused by energy imbalances? And
there are.
Maybe this is the origin of that.
And until I noticed this, I would have had a very low opinion of those theories. Yeah. It's like people that don't know anything imagine is going on. But no. I was very wrong in thinking that way, but they just noticed something that I'd never noticed. Actually, in general, you can probably always keep that in mind. I've had that experience many, many times. Anytime you think some of this, you have just no willingness to give credibility to other people's way of thinking, entertain the possibility that they may know something you don't. You may think that you know something they don't, and therefore you know better. But
And sometimes that's true. No doubt about it. Sometimes that's true. But you should always keep in mind it's quite possible they know something that you don't. Let's see, Ted has...
So I hate to go from all this prana excitement back to dullness, but something you said just made me want to clarify. It's my understanding that subtle dullness, if you're in a state of subtle dullness, you're not really sinking into gross dullness, but the object is less distinct, and you might have dreamlike sensations or dreamlike experiences. Is that true, or the dreamlike experience is only with gross dullness?
Well, you know, it's in my experience, those dreamlike distortions, I put in the category of strong dullness. Because I find it's most useful to use the term subtle dullness just for that loss of clarity and vividness and the fading of peripheral awareness and the pleasant sensations that come with it. And you have to recognize that this is, there's a certain arbitrariness to these definitions. But it's not totally arbitrary. I think it's very functional. Like, when you're in stage four, you want to keep working with dullness and regarding it as strong dullness and working with it seriously, including those where there's just that subtle dreamlike quality. So that's why I make my line of demarcation where I do.
Thanks.
Would you like to pass it back to Jason?
One more question about prana. So the experience that I have, or that I've associated with this, is when I'm paying attention to my hands, on like the in-breath is a feeling of something flowing like into them, and on the out-breath, coming out.
Yeah.
But I've noticed that this seems to depend on something that I'm doing with my mind, where it's like, if I hold my mind still in some way, then I don't get that. And there's this like feeling of, I don't know exactly how to describe it, that's like, seems to be causing the sensation. And if I just put my attention in my hand and move it around, then I get a very similar sensation. And I'm wondering if that's, is this not prana? Should I be looking for something else? Or is this something that seems to depend on how your attention is moving in your body?
Okay, what I would suggest is that you just keep observing it.
Yeah.
And since you have a sense that there's something you're doing with your mind. Now, moving your attention can give you something of the same experience of, you know, what is comparable to shining a bright light and then moving the bright light. So, you know, you'd be, I'm aware of my hand, now I'm aware of my arm, now I'm aware of my upper arm. But that's not the same thing as it feeling like there's something moving. You know, so, but the thing is to just keep observing as objectively as you can. And without judging, and if there's different things happening in your mind, then observe both different kinds of things.
Okay.
All right.
What are indications that you've sort of jumped the gun? Like, if you're sort of, you know, straddling stages 4 and 5, and you feel like you're having a few minutes of stage 5, so yeah, bring on the body scan. What are signs that it's premature and that you should...
Okay, the best indication that you're doing the body scan too early is that it becomes tiring, and either you start getting dull, or your mind starts getting restless and there's more distractions. And that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be doing the body scan at all, because when it's just right for you to do the body scan, if you're spending too long before you go back to the breath, you're going to get that kind of experience. It just means that you're spending more time on the body scan than you're ready for.
Okay.
Okay? So watch for that. If the purpose of the body scan is to brighten up your perception so that you can go back to the nose and you have that brighter perception. So if you're doing it and it's having the opposite effect, then you're doing it too long or too early. One or the other. But don't assume that it's necessarily too early. First, consider that maybe you just should do it for shorter periods of time. Because if you can do it for a shorter period of time, and that doesn't happen, and then you come back to the nose, and hey, that's bright and clear, and stays that way for a few breaths, then it's working. That's the way it should. Yeah. So, and, yeah.
And you mentioned the instructions to move to the breath, move your attention to the nose as soon as you notice it brightening, even if you're only partway through.
Right. Mm. That's right. Yeah. And as you go along, you know, it's you'll be able to scan larger areas of your body, more areas, larger areas, and you'll keep getting more and more brightening, and so you'll go longer before you return. The breath. So you can tell you're doing it right if two things. That over time you can do it for longer periods of time without getting tired or distracted. And when you come back to the breath, it stays brighter and clearer on the breath for longer and longer as you keep doing it. Until what you're looking for is that place where, you know, you can do the whole rest of your sit, and you're in a really bright, clear state. Or where if you feel yourself starting to move back towards dullness, then all you have to do is intend to brighten up, and then you're right back.
And then if you're doing a meditation where you're alternating between body scan and then returning to the sensations of the nose, and, you know, so you're not getting tired from it, you know, what proportion of the two activities might be acceptable? Like, would it be wrong to do, like, 3/4, say, on the body scan and only 1/4 on the sensations of the nose, or...?
You're talking about going back and forth?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what I suggest is you do a body scan until you feel like, you know, I'm experiencing a really nice level of mindfulness. You can sort of say to yourself, let me go back to the nose and see how long this lasts. And then when it starts to fade, and it's time to go back and do some more body scan. Just go back and forth that way. And so the proportions of each are going to change. And actually the direction is going to go. Well, in the beginning, you might find that if you... there's only part of a section that you can do body scanning and alternating between body scanning and the nose. You find that, that's enough. I just better stick with the nose for the rest of the time. So the proportion of time spent doing the body scan will be small for that reason. But then it'll get longer and longer, but so will the periods of that you stay on the nose. So you're about done with the body scanning when you sit down and you decide to do a little body scanning, and you very quickly, you know, you get up to a very strong experience of bright, clear, conscious awareness. And you go back to the nose and it just stays that way, or without doing any further body scanning. So you've kind of went from longer and longer and longer to now you're going lesser and lesser and lesser again. It's a tool. After a while, you need much less of the tool to achieve the purpose.
But if you're, say, not done with, you know, if you haven't reached that sort of lessening, you know, would it be wrong to, if you can pull it off without getting tired, to do a lot of the session body scan, or is it just an irrelevant?
Oh, it would be fine. What you're really doing there, and this is appropriate,
what you're really doing there is you're starting to do more of the whole body breath practice in stage six. And that's, you know, if you're at a point where you brighten things up and it stays really bright, then you're essentially at stage six, at least for that set. Maybe you won't be in the next one, but so that's the right thing to be doing. So the natural continuation of it would be to do that.
Okay, I'm just sort of planning ahead.
Right, and that's good. That's what I say, by the time you get to stage five, it's not a strict set of rules of this is how you're supposed to do it, this much of this, not too much of this. You know, you're becoming much more, you know a whole lot more about your mind, and you're able to try things and say to yourself, oh, this works or this doesn't work, and a lot of it's going to be discovery. So really, rather than looking for some kind of set guidelines, it's more, you know, if you're not sure, then you ask the teacher, okay, I'm doing this and this is happening, and somehow it doesn't seem right, and the teacher can say. Okay, well, different topic then. Anybody think much about what we were talking about yesterday when we left off? Remember what we were talking about yesterday?
Numa and Rupa.
What's that?
Numa
and Nama Rupa. And Rupa.
Nama and
yeah.
Rupa. And moments of consciousness.
And moments of consciousness. And the significance of being in the present.
And metacognitive introspective awareness as being the purpose of the practice.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So.
Can you talk about a bit about the yoga charas or yoga kara system?
Yeah, the interesting thing about these models of the mind, both the moments of consciousness model and the mind system model, is they come from branches of Buddhism or schools within Buddhism that are very, very heavily meditation oriented, as opposed to the thinkers and ponderers. There's a bit of funny terminology that shows up in the Pali commentaries. You know, distinguishes between jhanakas and ajhanakas. Okay, so a jhanaka is obviously somebody who practices intense meditation jhanas and things like that. And when you put an a in front of a word, it's a negation. But the thing is that the word ajhanaka also has another meaning. It's a word that means scholar. All right, so... I really like thinking and studying and things like that myself. But what I really favor are the schools of Buddhism whose views, theories, models, and so forth are heavily based on actual meditation experience more than analytic intellectual thinking. Right? And the Abhidhammists, they were serious meditators, and the Yogacharas as well. As a matter of fact, in the name, yoga and Yogacara doesn't refer to hatha yoga, it refers to meditation. And so the Yogacharans were developing models of the mind based on the insights that arise in meditation. And, of course, that's exactly what we started talking about. In the progress of insight, and I believe it's the 14th knowledge in the progress of insight. I brought some crib notes.
check and see here. Oh, 15. The 15th of the knowledges in the series of the progress of insight is the is path knowledge or awakening. So you have this whole series of insights that is building up to the moment of awakening. And the very first insight is the knowledge of nama and rupa, of mind and body. And the form that that insight takes is the is you know, as I mentioned yesterday, anybody who thinks about it at all tends to divide the world into mind and matter. The meditator quickly discovers a corresponding division in terms of what arises in consciousness are things that are mind-generated and things that come via the senses, the body, about the world. And so this is the category nama and rupa. And as the meditator continues, and of course this is where study, right understanding helps, because you get lots of cues to help you to direct your understanding towards certain aspects of your experience. So, nama and rupa are ultimately reducible to the experience of sensations and the experience of thoughts, memories, emotions, mental objects, right? The key thing is here, the experience of. That there is something called mind and that there is a material world, this is an inference that your mind makes. And with the moments of consciousness, each moment of consciousness has as its object either some mind-generated object, like a thought, or an emotion, or a memory, or an imagined image, or something like that, or it has a sensation. And you realize that your entire existence has consisted of these moments of consciousness that had either a sensation or a mental construct as an object. So, now, if you've studied Dhamma and you know something about this, when you're starting to notice these things, you might think something like, oh yes, the Buddha defined a person in terms of nama and rupa. That is, a person is nama and rupa. And that's what I'm discovering, that I consist of this sequence of experiences of nama and rupa. And, of course, I attribute them to something that's not a part of that experience. Because all I experience is a thought when I experience a thought. Or all I experience is a sensation when I experience a sensation. I'm having no direct experience of mind or matter, or mind and body, or anything like that. So I am these experiences of nama and rupa. And as the insight into nama and rupa deepens, you notice that your experiences, you know, it's like rupa, 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 and then nama, and nama, nama, and then some more rupa, and it's this mixture of nama and rupa. And you notice that the nama experiences are based on the rupa experiences. So you have a sensation, and then your mind recognizes it and puts a label on it, right? And then you have some more sensations, and then your mind interprets it and processes it some more, elaborates it and gives it meaning. And you keep watching it in this way, and you notice the relationship between the two. You notice that, we'll take these rupa experiences, the rupa experiences are related to each other, right? You have a series of sensations arrive, and of course, then when you have nama experiences, there's a story that says that explains how this series of sensations are related to each other. And so you say, oh, aha, rupa causes nama. Rupa causes rupa. You know, you see that these things are related. You see that this happens, and then that happens, and then that happens, and so you infer a series of causal events that are happening outside your mind. But you also see that rupa is causing nama. And also, one aspect of nama is intention. Right? So you see that, you know, I have the intention to have the intention to feel the sensations in my hand right now. Whoa. Now all of a sudden, my consciousness is filled with sensations from my hand. So now I change that to an intention to feel the sensations in my foot. And there you go. So nama is causing rupa. Or of course, I can have the intention to reach my finger out and I touch that shiny red thing and ouch, it's hot. Right? Nama causes rupa. Rupa causes nama. Nama causes nama. You come to realize that absolutely everything in this is, there's this causal relationship, this interconnectedness of everything. And you are the series of experiences. At some point, you begin to have the insight. Well, first of all, let's look at some other things that you might bring to your meditation experience that from your studies, which is the Buddha says when I refer to a person, I refer to, you know, nama and rupa. Nama and rupa equals the five aggregates. Okay. And the aggregates are consciousness and a certain collection of mental formations and then sensations. Okay, this is what I'm experiencing. I'm having moments of consciousness, and each moment has one or another kind of sensation and one or another kind of mental object, right? Mental formation, mental construct. So, where you say, now I'm starting to understand what the Buddha was talking about with his five aggregates. The aggregate of rupa, the rupa aggregate, that's all the sensations. That's blue and warm and salty and all these other things. Right? And I'm conscious of them. So consciousness is part of what I am. And I'm conscious of sensations, of rupa object. And I'm also conscious of nama object. And how did the Buddha categorize nama objects? Well, he said, they're basically... all nama objects are mental constructs. But he divided it up into three categories. Feelings, perceptions, and all the other mental constructs. They're all mental constructs. He singled feelings out as feeling pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And there's a reason why he does this. It has to do with the whole point of everything he taught, which is suffering and the end of suffering. And he singled out perceptions because that's, our perceptions are the world that we experience. Those are the mental constructs that represent what we think we are and the world that we think we live in and the continuing series of interactions. Those are all perceptions. That one very important category, important subset of mental constructs, our perceptions. And then he put the rest just in a big box that includes emotions, mental states, memories, abstract ideas, all these other kinds of things. Right. Yes?
Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt, but when you say perceptions, do you mean like sight, sound, hearing, that kind of perception?
When you say what?
Are you meaning like the sense organs, like sight, sound, hearing? Is that what you're meaning? You're meaning by perception?
No, perceptions are, you see, what's coming from your sense organ, what's coming from your eye is patterns of color and contrast.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then beyond that, there's a part of your brain that's really part of the sense organ, that it's constructing shapes from mm-hmm. from the light. Okay. No, perception is when you see a car, or a tree, or a bird, or a person. That's a perception. That's a mental construct. That's quite apart from the blueness and the redness and the darkness and the lightness and the more here-ness and less there-ness.
It's the brain pulling this out.
The perception is that mental construct by which you identify something. Okay. So the nature of a person is a series of moments of consciousness, and they contain one of the five general categories of sensations, and one or another of the three categories that the Buddha delimited of mental construct. But what about consciousness itself? If you pursue that in your meditation, what you discover, and this is what the Buddha said about the aggregate of consciousness, that the aggregate of consciousness is only consciousness of an object. You never find consciousness by itself. It's only consciousness of. There's consciousness of blue, and there's consciousness of the perception of a blue bird. There's consciousness of a feeling of pleasure because I like seeing a blue bird, and so on and so forth. So, when you examine this from the perspective that the Dhamma teachings give you, and you bring that into your meditation, and you begin to validate that, and at some point it dawns on you that in the hearing is only the hearing. You know, there's the hearing, and there's the object of the hearing. But there is no hearer. In the seeing, there's only the seeing. In the thinking, there's only the thinking. You start to realize that there's the knowing and the known and the knower. You know, there's the consciousness and the object of consciousness. But the knower that always held so much importance, that's huge importance, is nowhere to be found. It's an add-on. The mind adds it on. After you've heard, the mind adds on the hearer. I heard. After the thinking, after the feeling, the mind adds on the I thought, I felt. And so this insight into nama and rupa is... if you pursue it, it starts to lead into all kinds of other insight. So, to tie this back into the Yogacara, what the Yogacara realized, and what you realize when you begin to have insight into nama and rupa, is it's all about the mind. It is all about the mind. If I want to really understand what's going on, this is where I should look. Because otherwise, if, you know, I used to puzzle about this, you know, I was a seminary student at a Catholic university, and we studied all the Greek and Catholic philosophers and everything else, and I always wanted to know myself, but how do I know myself, you know? And, of course, it's obvious that you've got to look inward. You've got to look into your mind. What the Yogacara realized is that it's really all about the mind. Now, there was a subset of yogacharans that kind of went too far and said, there's only mind. But the important part of the yogacara view is to realize how very, very important that was. And so, you know, we have the imaginary reality of the world and ourselves. I am this, and I see you, and all of these things. And that's purely mind-created. But then there are the appearances that this is based on. Now, these are something real. These are the things that arise in your consciousness. They're real. So you've got your illusory reality, and then you have this reality of mind-generated appearances. Now, one of the things that comes somewhere along the way is the realization that even the contents of your sensory experience are also mental in nature. This is very profound realization. That what, you know, just as words and ideas and concepts are all symbols created by the mind to represent something else, blue and salty are as well. It's just a mental symbol that's been created to represent a particular, in this case, it represents a certain kind of sensory data coming in. You experience it as blue, and you experience it as salty, and you experience it consistently that way every time. But the blueness does not exist. And of course, we have an advantage that Buddha and the Yogacharans didn't have, which is we have physical sciences that can tell us, yeah, that's right, there's no such thing as blue, and there's no such thing as salty. That's an interpretation that your mind puts on something. So all of a sudden we realize that even our sensations are mental constructs. In other words, all objects of consciousness have been generated by the mind. Now this is where you can kind of slip off track and say, oh, wow, then maybe there isn't anything out there at all. Maybe my mind is just dreaming the whole thing up. But if you don't get too excited about this notion and think about it, you realize, no, that's not true. Because there is something that is completely outside of your mind's control that determines whether you have the experience of blueness or redness or saltiness or bittersweet, so on and so forth. And that whatever that unknown thing is that triggers blueness and saltiness and so forth that arise in your mind follows its own laws and follows them very, very consistently. Whereas you can imagine all kinds of things, but the things in your imagination don't demonstrate that kind of consistency. You can control them. So it's very interesting though to have this realization that everything you've ever known is a construct generated by your mind. It's also important when you realize that to realize that there's one whole category of these, which are sense perceptions, and here we're not talking about hallucinations or dreamlike sense perceptions, because you can have that kind too, and you can even have vivid imagination. But there, we could distinguish real sensations from contrived by the mind sensations. But nevertheless, everything that you experience originates from with your own mind. And that is an amazing realization. That changes everything. You also, if you appreciate that qualia, things like blue and salty, the qualia are just symbols. And, you know, how symbols are attributed is arbitrary, right? So, you know, it's quite possible that when I point and say, see that blue thing over there? That when Nick says, turns his eyes towards it and says, the subjective experience that he had, if I could see it from inside his mind, would be salty. And it would make no difference at all. As long as whatever qualia was produced by a given object did so consistently in his mind and consistently in my mind, we would never ever know these differences. Their sensations are mind-generated, are completely mind-generated. They have no reality of their own, no reality independent of the mind. Mind is really everything. In terms of, if I'm going to try to understand reality, if I'm going to try to understand myself and the universe and my relationship to it, this is what I've got to work with. Okay, but I'm not living in some solipsistic dream, because I can also see that there is something other than my own mind that is determining the kinds of sensations that arise, and they're following their own rules. An extension of this is, you can extend this to everything. You see that absolutely everything that I know by means of my senses is following laws of causality. Once I realize that, I can start to try to discern what those laws of causality are. I can start to create a picture of the universe. And this is what science says, right? You know. But also in my mind, everything that happens in my mind is also following rules of causality. In your meditation, you see the relationship between rupa and nama and nama and rupa. So these realms of causality, they interact. But everything is causal. As a matter of fact, when an idea comes up in your mind, or when an emotion arises, it has causes. You may not know those causes, but it's there as a result of causes and conditions. So that you can be certain. So absolutely everything, both mind and matter, is operating on the basis of a universal causal principle. And the way in which it happens, there are laws governing the way it happens, which we can ferret out. We can, through careful, accurate examination, trying not to jump to conclusions too quickly, trying not to project too much, but careful examination, we can start to understand the laws that govern the material world and the mind. Of course, as we discover the laws that govern the mind, we're also discovering the laws that determine a lot of what happens outside the mind as well. Because there are other, you know, you always knew this, there are other entities out there that are also independent of your mind. And by inference, you can realize that they have minds. As a matter of fact, this is something that's called in developmental psychology, theory of mind. And children at an early age develop theory of mind. But some things have minds like they do, and other things don't. Of course, it takes them a while to sort out that, you know, between the difference between real puppy dogs and stuffed puppy dogs. Right? But they do it. They develop a really well-developed theory of mind, and they realize that mind and matter are governed by laws and causality. So this is the beginnings of insight.
You wanted to say something?
Oh, it's kind of not terribly relevant, but I'm just thinking of how I was trying to teach a child that a dog's mind is not like a human's mind, and the dog does not like getting hugged, and the kid, this was very, very difficult for the kid to understand that the dog's mind was different than her mind.
Oh, yes, and as a matter of fact, that is part of that's one of the things that happens in development that they study. That, you know, there's a period that children go through where they assume that anything they know, everybody else knows.
Yeah.
And there's actually a particular age when the child discovers that something could go on in their mind that doesn't go on in other minds. So they generated a theory of mind, but there's a point where which they can't distinguish the differences between their minds and others, but later on they do.
That's kind of beautiful, actually.
It's beautiful. It's wonderful how the whole thing happens. Anyway, it's getting to be time to quit for today. But, you know, we come to a very interesting place in understanding. The insight after the insight into nama and rupa is the insight into the conditioned nature of things, conditionality. And then comes what it's technically called in the Theravadin formulation is the comprehension by groups. But that's where you start to take these Dhamma study ideas, like the five aggregates and nama and rupa, and the six sense bases, and the six types of sense objects, and the six types of consciousness. And you begin to weave together this theoretical framework with this experiential framework, and now it's starting to give rise to true insight. Whereas at some point you could recite the five aggregates and the six sense bases and everything, and intellectually you knew what that was all about, but now it starts to be a much more gut level understanding of, oh, been there, seen that, I know what this is about, that sort of thing. And so these are very important early insights in the progress of insight. So we can continue talking about this tomorrow. I'd ask you to think about it. Not too much, just a little bit. Okay. Not too much thinking. And if you have some questions, and we can see where we might go with this tomorrow. So there's a lot of directions that you can go from here.
Could you just quickly clarify the difference between consciousness, say, consciousness of blue and blue, and consciousness of Yoda and Yoda? What is the distinction being made there?
Okay. The distinction there is, it's the same. All we can ever experience is consciousness of. But we can recognize that there's two parts to this. There's the object of consciousness, the blue and the Yoda, and it comes in many different forms. But then there's the consciousness part of it, which you can never find by itself, but what seems quite evident and which you can validate for yourself by investigation is that's pretty invariant. It only takes different forms according to the different objects and the different categories of objects. Does that answer the question? So experience, from direct experience, all we can know is consciousness of blue. What is inferred is that there's a blue separate from the consciousness. And that's only inference. And, you know, the thing is that you can leave your keys on the table and then you can turn away. And you don't really know that the keys are still there. But when you look back, or when you go back in the room again,
most of the time, they're still there. So we come to infer that the keys have an existence independent of our conscious experience. The insight is that that is forever totally unverifiable. It's only an assumption. It's an inference, and you can use that inference very productively, and we do, of necessity, right? But insight is realizing that it's never verifiable, that your experience is, the keys only exist when you're conscious of the keys. And likewise, consciousness only exists when it's consciousness of something. And that's important because we go through the world thinking that the knower is real and that the knowing has an independent reality of its own, and that the known is real and likewise has an independent reality of its own. So we divide the world up into me, the knower, the process of the knowing, and the known. But when we come down to it, we realize there is nothing but the knowing of the object, and the knower and the independent existence of the object, and the idea that the knowing is, could have any kind of independence. Now the thing is, when we use the word knowing, most people say, well, yeah, there can't be any knowing unless you know something, right? And they, well, what about consciousness? Well, I don't know, that seems different somehow. I can see there might be consciousness. But experientially, you can't. It's like consciousness is knowing, and knowing is consciousness. And you might prefer to think that there could be consciousness without an object, but you could do it on experience. That you'd like to think there can be an object without consciousness, and you'd like to think there could be someone who is conscious, and sometimes they're conscious and sometimes they're not, but they're always there because they're self-existently real. But the insight is where you start to undo the underpinnings of this way of looking at and understanding things. Starting to understand emptiness. The other thing you get from in meditation, from watching all of this, is you see nama and rupa arising and passing away, and arising and passing away, and arising and passing away. And you see that all this arising and passing away is causally interconnected. The more you contemplate that, at some point it kind of dawns on you that, wow, there's nothing but process here. That's insight into impermanence. So impermanence and emptiness arise from the observations that you do in meditation. And they require staying in the present. Because after all, what is the past?
Mental construct.
It's a mental construct that you're experiencing in the present. Mm-hmm. How much resemblance does that mental construct bear to what you think happened? Not much. And what is the future? It's another mental construct. And we may go through our lives assuming that the mental constructs we generate in the present that purport to represent the past are mostly pretty accurate, even though if we're ever tested on it, we find out they're not. But if we're honest with ourselves, the mental constructs that we hold in the present about the future are usually about 90% wrong. Of course, the 10% that they're right can be very, very useful, but I think we have to quit for today. There's only 4 minutes for you to stretch for the onset.